All right, this meeting of the House Labor and Commerce Committee will now come to order. It is 3:17 on Friday, April 24th, here in the Anchorage Legislative Information Office in the Dan Alley Conference Room. Our members, I'm going to call the roll call for those that are calling in online. Representative Hannon? Representative Gillis? Members? Hello, who's that just joined?
Sorry, this is Rep. Rasmussen.
Hi, Representative Rasmussen. Is Representative Hannon here?
Representative Hannon here in Juneau, trying to shut you off on the video.
Sorry, Henry. Thanks. Representative Gillis? Representative Story?
Yes, hello from Juneau.
Hi. Representative Stoops? Representative Fields? All right. And myself, Representative Sponholz, Chair. Are there any representatives online that I haven't recognized?
Andy Josephson.
Representative Josephson, thank you for joining us. All right. Let's the record reflect
that we have a Representative Merrick.
All right. Representative Merrick, thank you for joining us. All right, let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. Thanks for members of the committee and our guests for joining us here via teleconference. Given that we're meeting via teleconference, if you can keep your phones on mute until you need to speak, that'll help keep the live stream as clear as possible. Before we begin, I want to thank Sophia Tenney, the Labor and Commerce Secretary from House Records, Taylor Kelly from the Juneau LIO for staffing the committee today in Juneau, as well as Vanessa here at the Anchorage LIO. Today we have several presenters who have been involved in helping us to understand and respond to the economic impacts of the public health measures to prevent the spread of COVID-19. This hearing is being live streamed on the legislature's website, and the documents for today's presentation are also available on our website. You can find all of that at www.akleg.gov. First up, we have Musin Ghatabi with the University of Alaska's Institute for Social and Economic Research. Then we'll have Nolan Clouda with the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development. Then we'll hear from Lori Wolf with the 4-Acre Group. And finally, we'll hear from Bill Popp of the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation on a recent business survey that his organization conducted. We have a lot to cover today. I will periodically take breaks to ask if committee members have questions. But go ahead and shoot me a text or just speak up if you want to ask a question and I haven't gotten to you then. My apologies, Professor Ghatabi, you there?
Yes, I am.
All right, welcome. You want to go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and begin your presentation?
Yeah, Musin Ghatabi, Associate Professor of Economics at the University of Alaska Anchorage at ICER. Thank you for having me. So,
thank you for joining us.
I will go ahead and jump in. It's an ambitious presentation. I know that my time is limited, and so we may not get through the whole thing, but I will try to kind of focus on themes that I'm hoping will be useful to you all in thinking about this situation. I've done an analysis before we had any data available about the potential economic impacts of COVID-19 on the Alaska economy. I'm on slide 3 here. And by the way, if you've got the presentation open on a computer, anything that's in text and is in blue means that there is an embedded link in there. And so you can go to the actual link if you want more information about something that I discuss. The presentation today is, as I've said, ambitious. It's going to try to cover some findings from my previous work, and then I will tell you what we potentially or what I think we know about the effect of COVID-19 on people, on businesses, on local governments and communities, and then on the budget. One thing before I jump in that's changed as an economist, and I'm sure for all of you that are trying to keep up with the potential economic effects, is on slide 4, I show a number of resources that have become available over the last few weeks that give us near real-time information about how people are responding to some of the mandates, in particular Google Mobility Reports and SafeGraph, which tell us how many people are visiting workplaces or visiting retailers or restaurants or that type of thing, because as you all know, economic data comes out with a lag, and you all need good, solid information, and we just don't have that right now. So I've relied quite heavily on some of these newer resources to track both how people are responding to social distancing measures, but also to potentially start understanding how people frequent some of the establishments that will get reopened over the upcoming days and weeks. And one such example is shown on slide 5, where I basically look at how this is the change, the percentage change in the number of visits or time spent at retail and recreation establishments in Anchorage relative to the period between January 3rd and February 6th. And the takeaway there, and not surprising, is that there is basically about 40% less traffic since March 15th than there was between January 3rd and February 6th. If you want a little more information about this, you can click on the word here on slide 5, and it will take you to a 6- or 7-pager summary that I've put together. But that's just as background in kind of how we should be thinking about some of these things. So I'll summarize things that we already know on slide 6, but I think it's important to kind of just remind everybody of where we are. As all of you, I've been referring to the economy as either being frozen or in a coma, and we've done so for public health reasons, and those are the right reasons, but that has resulted in obviously unprecedented insurance and employment filings. It's also resulted in many businesses having been closed down. In addition, one of the things that I will discuss a little bit later is that while the Alaska economy is frozen right now, we do anticipate what is typically a large tourism and fishing season, and both of those are in serious jeopardy. And so we have this very important window now where the bump in economic activity that we typically get is potentially not coming, and so that will add on to the economic stresses that we're currently experiencing. And then I cringe every time I have to talk about oil, but as you all know, we are in unprecedented territory there, and so that obviously has consequences for the budget, but also for the economy at large. Oil sector has employs about 14 or 15,000 people with an average monthly wage of over $10,000. And we know that there are very significant ripple effects if indeed these lower oil prices hold. So I'll move on to what we actually potentially know. And these are some hard numbers that we know, not much. You all have seen the same numbers. The state has received that $1.25 billion. I don't want to get into the details of how it's being allocated, because I know that there is a serious conversation about how it can and can't be used, but we do know that 62,000 Alaskans have filed for unemployment insurance. If you divide that number by the size of the labor force in February, that tells you that 17% of the Alaskans have filed for, or 17% of the labor force has filed for unemployment insurance, and that's something that we've just never seen before. Additionally, we know that there are almost 5,000 firms that have received aid in the form of PPP with an average amount of $190,000. Again, if you take that 4,842 and divide it by the overall number of firms in Alaska, that tells you that 22% of all firms have received some aid. We know that money has run out, but we know that there is another package that's supposed to replenish some of that money, with an emphasis on smaller businesses, so that's obviously important. And so I will try to navigate these different areas as I go through my presentation. I moved to slide 8, and here, again, I just want to spend 2 minutes explaining to you the exercise that I did, because I think it's important in just thinking about the scale of the effect. So in the middle of March, we knew nothing about how bad this was going to be, and so I did a really simple exercise. I said, assume that 50% of the leisure and hospitality industry gets laid off, assume that 20% of retail gets laid off, and assume that 20% of transportation and warehousing employees get laid off. What does that mean in terms of direct effects, and what does that mean in terms of indirect and induced effects or ripple effects? And what I find, and at the time this number seemed really large, I find just from assuming these three things, 50% reduction in leisure and hospitality, 20% in retail, and 20% in transportation, that once you account for the ripple effect, I was essentially expecting that April 2020 employment numbers were going to be 48,000 jobs less than April of 2019. And as I said a minute ago, we've already exceeded that number because there are 62,000 people that have filed for unemployment insurance. I do the exact same exercise I described for GDP, that's gross domestic product or gross state product. And again, I find just from my basic assumptions, and again, we've already exceeded them, that GDP for the second quarter, that's April through June, would be $2 billion less than the previous year, just from the direct effect. If you account for the indirect effect, GDP would be $4 billion less. An important caveat is that in none of this did I actually fully account for the oil price declines, and we all know how significant the oil value is in the determination of Alaska's GDP. So my point is, from my basic analysis, I reached the conclusion that by the end of April, we would have 48,000 fewer jobs, GDP would be $4 billion less, and that's before accounting for the decline in oil prices. The reality is we've already exceeded that expectation that seemed crazy a few weeks ago, and now we're looking at much lower oil prices, and we're looking at even more people being unemployed than even I anticipated. And so the situation's gone from precarious to even more so. In slide 10, just to give you a sense again of vulnerability, what I do is I decompose the economy into the sectors that you see in front of you, and I basically say, what's the share of the Alaska employment in these quote-unquote vulnerable sectors? And what I define as vulnerable sectors are natural resource and mining, that's oil and gas, manufacturing, that's mainly seafood processing, professional and business services, because that's closely tied to oil and gas, and then leisure and hospitality. And then I also include state and local governments, because we know if there are cuts, especially at the local level, due to declines in expected declines in sales taxes and bet taxes, that's going to take a significant bite out of that employment. So just from those sectors that I listed, that's almost half of the Alaska employment. And so that gives you a sense, at least for me, that gives me a sense of exposure, right? And so what are the sectors that are potentially exposed to some of these declines? In slide 11, I do the same exercise, remove state and local government, but then look at it at the borrow level. And this is really important in my estimation as a regional economist, because it really gives us a good sense of the variation in dependence across boroughs on different sectors. Now, why does that matter? That matters because obviously the wages of the different sectors matters, and again, the timing or the scale of the decline in these sectors is also going to matter a great deal. So if we, for example, look at Bristol Bay and Denali, just because they're close to each other, and this is on slide 11, Denali's employment is almost 75% in leisure and hospitality, and that's your hotels, your motels, that's basically a lot of tourism activity. And then you look right next to it, Bristol Bay, and surprisingly, a lot of employment in seafood processing. And again, so that tells us that across boroughs, the shocks that I described are going to reverberate very differently depending on your industrial structure, or dependent, which raises the question about whether or not some of the aid, whether federal or state, should be based on place or should be based on sector. And so, again, it's large, it's significant, but it varies from place to place. The picture gets even uglier if you go to slide 12, where now I add state and local government on top of those other three sectors. And what you can see is that local government employment obviously is a big chunk of employment across boroughs, and that, to me, again, highlights another source of vulnerability, and that's stemming from the expected declines in sales taxes and bed taxes in particular. Just those two account for a little over $300 million in revenues. And so if those are not replaced and if those local governments start shedding jobs, then you're going to have government decline in addition to private sector shocks stemming from either a smaller fishing season or a smaller tourism season.
Professor Kadhadi?
So, yes.
I'm going to interrupt you here. Is fishing fall under natural resources and mining?
No, sorry. So fishing. So what I have here, so this is wage and salary employment. So this does not have any self-employed individuals. Manufacturing has within it seafood processing. And so these are, that has within it employees who receive a paycheck as a seafood, if they work in seafood processing. Natural resource and mining has in it oil and gas and mining. That's it.
Thank you.
Does that answer your question?
It does. Do any of the committee members on the line have any questions at this moment? All right, proceed.
Okay. So, I again, this on slide 13, I basically summarized a lot of what I told you, which is, to me, it's a really striking image to just look at this varying dependence and what that potentially is going to mean in terms of the scale of the damage or the type of economic packages that we're thinking about in order to stabilize economic activity. And so I'll pivot now to things that I know all of you have been thinking about. So on slide 14, I provide hopefully a little bit of context about just how large this shock is. And so what you see in, I think, pink or red, are the total or cumulative jobs that we've lost between 2015 and 2018 due to the previous decline in oil prices. So during that very long recession that all of us remember, Alaska lost a total of 11,438 jobs. In just the past 5 weeks, we have more than 62,000 people file for unemployment insurance claims. So in 5 weeks, we have unemployment insurance claims that are five times the overall amount of jobs that were lost in Alaska's longest recession. And so that, to me, it stands out in terms of just how big the shock is to the statewide economy. So moving on to slide 15, now, one could debate that and say, well, those were real job losses. We don't really know what these layoffs or these furloughs actually mean. Plus, there is a significant amount of aid that's been allocated by the federal government to individuals that are negatively affected. So in slide 15, I basically summarize the federal aid. We know that there is $600 per week for up to 4 months. That means $2,400 per month just from the federal UI or unemployment insurance. There is also a one-time $1,200 stimulus check that phases out at $99,000. And we know that in the state, typically the average state UI is about $250 per week. Now, what does that actually mean? In slide 16, I hope that this is helpful in thinking about whether or not an individual's wages are being covered by the federal aid or not. And so what I do is I basically list out how much people are going to be getting depending on their yearly wages. And so what you see on the very left column are yearly wages, $25,000 to $95,000, and then I divide that amount by 12, that's the monthly wage, and then I list out the federal UI stimulus checks and state UI, and I take the difference between what I refer to as aid and then lost wages. So what's the takeaway there? So for the first month of this shock, anybody that's making or that was making less than $60,000 and has gotten laid off, and an important caveat, is a wage and salaried employee or was a wage and salaried employee, will be getting more from the federal slash state aid slash stimulus checks than he or she was making beforehand. Anybody that's making more, that was making more than $60,000 is not getting enough aid to replace their wages. And the last column shows you the exact amount, the net difference for every wage category. Now, a really important point here is that that's just for the first month, because as I've said earlier, the stimulus checks are a one-time distribution. So what I do on slide 17 is I graph essentially, so the blue line is the table that you just looked at, and then I also graph what happens in month two when we no longer have the stimulus checks. And what happens is that break-even point drops from 60,000 to 45,000. So anybody that's making less than $45,000 in month two will be getting more money from federal slash state aid than they were making beforehand. But if you were making more than $45,000, then you're actually not having your wages replaced. I'll stop here for a second in case there is confusion or if somebody wants to ask questions.
Are there any questions? And I'll just underscore that this is only for people that are eligible for current unemployment plus the federal wage replacement. This is not applicable for those that are self-employed.
Absolutely, yeah. So everything here is just for wage and salaried employees.
All right, thank you.
Yeah. So on slide 18, I basically use that same information and use the IRS data, and I ask the question, well, how many Alaskans does this potentially cover? And so what I basically do is I look at the share of returns, tax returns, that have an adjusted gross income below $50,000. And the answer to that question is, in 2017, there were 55% of all tax returns filed in Alaska that had an adjusted gross income below than $50,000. So that should give us a bit of a sense about how many people are potentially protected by these measures or these aid packages that I've described. And then on slide 19, I pivot to the question that you just raised, which is, well, none of this aid really is dealing directly with self-employed individuals, and based on tax returns, there are 44,000 returns that have some self-employment tax, and that's a proxy for self-employed individuals, and that represents 13% of all filed returns in the state. The other thing that this points out is there is significant heterogeneity or variation in the share of returns across the state that have some self-employment tax, which gets me back to the point I made earlier, that any aid is going to have to take into account this potential variation across places in where people's money comes from, whether sectorally or whether they're actually a wage employee or not. And so this basically on page 20, it's a little bit of a summary of what I just showed you. Plus, as I've said, and I think all of you know better than I, that there are some serious questions that remain about how quickly some of the aid is reaching people and whether it's comprehensive enough. And so there are still questions about whether or not these calculations are actually reflective of the pain on the ground or not, because we don't know as of yet how many people have gotten all the aid that I just described. And so if you're not tired enough of this kind of thinking about federal aid, I do the same exercise, but I do it now by looking at sectors. So what you see, the bars are the average monthly wage for every sector in Alaska, and then the horizontal lines show you the federal unemployment insurance. So the blue line is the federal unemployment insurance. The red line is federal unemployment insurance plus state unemployment insurance. And then the orange line has all of the aid plus the stimulus checks. The biggest takeaway is that with the stimulus check, essentially almost every industry, so the aid is almost covering the average monthly wage of just about every industry with the exception of construction, natural resource and mining, and federal government. The moment you take away the stimulus check, then there are many industries that now have an average wage that exceeds the state UI and the federal UI, which means that there are some gaps that emerge essentially in month two of the lockdowns the moment you take away the stimulus checks. Moving on to slide 22, and this is maybe too much detail, but I think it's important to keep in the back of your mind. I think I've said it before to people, but I don't think we should conflate these initial claims for unemployment insurance with unemployment rates, because the definitions have shifted quite a bit. People no longer have to be actively looking for a job in order to receive unemployment insurance. And we don't know if some of these employer-employee separations are permanent or temporary. And that obviously matters a great deal in thinking about the recovery. A lot of the reasons why PPP was very attractive at the beginning is that it was meant to keep a lot of employees attached to their employer so that if / when we reopen the economy, those people can jump right back to work. And then there is this little summary that I link to that kind of gets into more detail if you're interested. I'll pivot towards businesses. And again, I think it's important in slide 23, there are really two points that matter here. One is that we have a lot of small businesses in the state. Almost 90% of all firms in Alaska have fewer than 20 employees. The other thing that matters a great deal here is, again, the last bullet, which says that seasonality is very, very large in Alaska. And if you compare the total wages in the economy, there is about $437 million more in total wages in July than there is in January, typically. That's using 2019 numbers. And obviously, all of that money is in jeopardy. And this slide 24 just shows you that same information, but shows you how many firms there are by size using slightly older data. But again, the thing still holds that we have 90% of firms that are small, which means they're vulnerable, which means they typically operate on razor-thin margins. And those are the ones that probably need most of the aid in rounds 2, 3, 4, and 5. Same thing, accommodation and food services, the sector that's been hit the hardest. 50% of the firms in this sector have fewer than 5 employees. And so these are your small restaurants. And again, those are sectors that basically have no income right now. And we don't know how many firms by sector, or I don't know, how many firms by sector have received aid as of yet, and that's important to keep in mind as well. And then lastly on this point, what I do in page 26 is I divide the overall amount that was allocated to Alaska firms, the $900+ million, by the overall annual payroll in Alaska. And what you see there is that $900 million that was allocated only represents 6% of the state's annual payroll. Now, that basically says that, yes, the aid was large, but if we are looking at an environment where a lot of these firms have had these temporary shocks to income that are going to last for multiple months, then there is going to need to be multiple rounds in order to keep them whole, and that the current aid package, as distributed, without counting what's coming in the next couple of weeks, is inadequate in terms of covering a long enough period of annual wages. I know that you have other presenters, and I think I've been speaking for 30 minutes, and so you tell me whether you want me to stop or, yeah.
I think we can give you about 5 more minutes.
Okay.
Then
what I'm going to...
Representative Hannon.
Thank you. I have a question. If Dr. Mutavi, could you remind me the $900 million that you're referring to, where is that coming from?
Yeah, so that's the total PPP money that was allocated to Alaska firms.
Okay. That could be allocated to Alaska firms, or is that what has been...
That's what already has been allocated to Alaska firms.
Thank you.
Yeah. So there are 4,800 firms that have received a total of $900 million in aid for an average amount of $190,000. So I'll skip page 27 because it just asks questions. And then on page 28, I basically remind you all, which you already know, that there is this big gap in local government revenues that will emerge, and that's really important to think about because, as you know, VET taxes in particular basically are raised over the span of 2 months, and that's not something that can be made up in October or November or December. And so I'll just use my last couple of minutes to just re-emphasize the seasonality point. And the reason I'm harping on this is because the economy is currently frozen and typically gets this big bump of activity in June, July, and August. And on page 29, I just summarize what that, how big that bump actually is. So there are 35,000 more jobs in July statewide than there are in January. And a lot of those jobs are essentially coming in two sectors, leisure and hospitality and the fishing season. That's manufacturing, that's processing. And none of this is accounting directly for the self-employed jobs that we know exist in both of those sectors. So this is a very conservative estimate for how much the Alaska economy grows over the summer, and we know that all of this is in serious jeopardy. This, in slide 30, I just show you the sectoral decomposition. The local government decline there is just the teachers, and so that's an artificial decline, if you will, which means that the actual bump in activity is bigger than the 35,000 that I've described. And one of the things that I've been thinking about, and I'll close with this, is that both of these summer sectors have a very, very large share of non-resident employees. Now, on the one hand, one can think about that as potentially good, which means that a lot of the jobs that typically get created go to non-residents, which means that even if they don't get created, it's the burden is not going to simply be borne by Alaska residents. The other point that's important to keep in mind here is that a lot of these people do spend money in these communities, and that the channels of revenues that is collected from some of these sectors is not just employment. And so the same point is made on slide 32, which basically tells you that a non-negligible share of employees in the sectors that are seasonal, where that summer bump happens, are non-residents, which raises questions from a public health standpoint, meaning if these seasons do occur, how will the state deal with it? And then it raises questions about if there is aid that's going to be allocated, you want to make sure that it's surgical enough to where it potentially hits the pockets of Alaska residents. So I'll stop because I think I've already gone over my time. The remaining slides are just about the budget, and I'm assuming you've had your fair share of presentations related to the budget. Thank you for having me, and I'm happy to answer questions if there are any.
Thank you very much, Dr. Kadabi. Are there any questions for Dr. Kadabi?
This is Rep. Rasmussen. I have a quick question.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Dr. Kadabi. Could you tell me what you think the biggest driver that as policymakers we could do to help kind of weather through this economic downturn?
The simplest, shortest answer is give money to businesses to keep employees on the payroll and give people money to get through this. And so I have been really clear that I think that aggressive action that keeps people attached to their employers is really, really important. And also that while the federal aid's been aggressive, the stimulus check is a one-time decision.
Mr.
Pop,
could you put yourself on mute?
Oh, yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Yeah, so I think aid to local governments, aid to individuals, and aid to businesses. I know that there are some important trade-off questions, but I think that the Alaska economy is experiencing shocks that we've never seen before, and I think that the state / the federal government are the only entities that can spend money right now, because I just don't see where demand is going to come from outside of those two channels.
2 weeks of quarantine. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Mr. Pop, we can still hear you.
Chair Sponholz, this is Rep. Hannon.
Representative Hannon, go ahead.
Dr. Kadabi, the numbers you gave us, the $900 million for the PPP program is substantial. But the whole sector of businesses that are not eligible for that, the seasonal restaurants and businesses in my region that by definition are seasonal, and most of them are locally owned and locally hired, but they're not reflected in that data of what kind of need they have. Are there any tools that you could point us to or that are at your disposal to measure what their need is for their payroll replacement? What are the lost earnings if my restaurant doesn't reopen this summer?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and really, to be honest with you, one of the biggest questions that I've had over the last couple of months is the fact that because of seasonality, we have this second wave coming that none of those businesses have been accounted for fully. And to answer your question directly, I think that the best way to do this would be at the local level, working with economic development agencies, surveying those firms, identifying them through records of small businesses, and really dealing with them directly, meaning creating as quick an inventory as possible of the firms that operate within each borough or each community, and then removing as much red tape as possible to get money in their pockets really quickly and bypass as many channels as possible. I think that anything that tries to just allocate overall money to overall firms is going to fall short. I think sectoral ways of doing it, meaning picking up sectors that we know are going to hurt in 2 months and going after them, or doing it place by place, makes a lot of sense to me. And I really would work directly with a lot of agencies that I know are doing really good work, and you're going to hear from this afternoon.
Thank you.
Are there any questions? Any additional questions? All right. Thank you very much for your presence today. This was very useful and very interesting, and I encourage people to read through the last couple of pages regarding the drop in oil prices. The share of revenue in the state of Alaska that comes from investment revenues, which is the POMB for the permanent fund versus petroleum revenues. Our fiscal situation has dramatically changed in the last few days, but that topic has been covered a lot in House Finance recently, which I know a lot of us have been following as well. So thank you very much for your presentation today, Professor Kadabi. It was very useful. Next up, we've got Nolan Clauda with the UAA Center for Economic Development. You want to introduce yourself and proceed with your presentation?
Yes. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm Nolan Clauda, for the record. I'm the Executive Director at the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development. I wanted to start off by echoing some of Musin's thoughts and sharing a little bit of commentary about where we are economically overall. I think that it's not really hyperbole to say that we are probably dealing with what might be the biggest economic challenge in our lifetimes. I really think that is potentially the case. We've seen unemployment rise faster and higher than has really ever happened before, at least in our state. And I think these measures are things that I just didn't think would ever happen. The way that the stock market tumbled, the way that companies or businesses have had to shut down at least temporarily, how many of those temporary shutdowns become permanent shutdowns. These are all major problems and major concerns. I think that COVID is almost like a kind of a slow-moving natural disaster, like a slow-moving hurricane or earthquake that's hitting the whole planet at once. It's a scale that we really just would have had a hard time comprehending, I think, until recently, at least for most of us. So dealing with it is something that presents some pretty tremendous challenges. If you look at slide three, I'm going to gloss over this really quickly because I think Musin covered this really well. But the Alaska Department of Labor had listed out the most vulnerable sectors in Alaska, and about these account for around 90,000 jobs. And we've lost about 60,000 jobs already, and not necessarily just from these sectors, but by one measure, the U.S. economy. Musin mentioned the issue about the lag in calculating unemployment. It usually takes about 2 months. There's one real-time estimate out there for the national economy that says that our current unemployment rate nationwide is probably a little bit over 20%. And if Alaska's unemployment rate went up by the same amount, we would be a little bit even higher than that, because our unemployment rate was running a bit higher than the U.S. average as of February or March. So, you know, these are pretty serious challenges. If you look at slide number four, I asked the Department of Labor to provide a breakdown of the unemployment claims by which industry or sector that they came from, and this is just for the month of March. These are showing where the initial round of layoffs went, broken down by industry percentage, and almost 20% of them were in accommodation and food services, which is not too surprising. You know, bars and restaurants were the first to lay people off because of the mandates and because of the need for social distancing. Construction, manufacturing that you see there is mostly seafood processing. Healthcare and social assistance, believe it or not, even though the medical system is ramping up, a lot of clinics have had to draw down to make room for more capacity in the healthcare system and so forth. So on slide five, I wanted to dig into a kind of an aspect of this that's worth some special attention, which is how businesses are coping and really digging into the health of businesses right now. This study that I found, this was just published within the last few days by the National Bureau of Economic Research, and it's the most exhaustive survey of businesses that I've seen to date. 5,800 U.S. small businesses, including some from Alaska, that were a part of this. And on slide six, some key takeaways from that I think really deserve some emphasis are that 43% of businesses, as of the time that this was written, were currently closed, and this is just as of probably a few weeks ago, and what the data reflects. Almost half of businesses currently closed, at least on a temporary basis. That on average, employers have cut headcounts by 40%. That when we're talking about these small businesses, these are obviously big numbers. And also getting into the financial health of businesses, which I think is where this particular study has a lot of value, the median business, so if you could think of this as the typical business, has around $10,000 in monthly expenses. And that same typical business has generally less than 1 month of cash on hand. And so you think about the business's burn rate, what they're going to need to go through, what expenses they have, and what reserves they have to cover it. And it starts to make us really worry about the health of our small business. Slide number seven what that's showing, that's breaking down which percentage of businesses that that responded and how many months of cash they have on hand. You see that the largest share have 1 or 2 months worth of cash, and a very large share has less than 1 month of cash. Very few businesses have, you know, 6 months to a year worth or more than that. So businesses are, just like many households, are 1 or 2 paychecks away from not being able to pay their rent or their basic living expenses. That's also, in a lot of cases, true of businesses, that they don't happen to have cash reserves to float a long period of earning no revenue. And so this is something that's happening, you know, within our state, within our whole country, within a lot of places around the world. And our small businesses are obviously really paying the price for this. On slide 8, the same research looked at the businesses in terms of, and asked them how likely they were to stay open, to remain operating, whether they're temporarily opened or not. How long could they remain operating under the current circumstances with social distancing in different time periods? And so this is how many businesses said that they could remain open after 4 months, broken down by industry. So, you know, starting at the top, the banking and finance and professional services companies, they said that 63% of them said we would be able to stay open, you know, in 4 months in these current types of circumstances, which is, and those are the best one, the strongest businesses, according to this. And that still leaves a huge share of them that said that they aren't certain about their ability to stay open. If you look at the bottom of this, that's where you see restaurants and bars, where less than a third believe that they could stay open for 4 months of social distancing amid this pandemic. Non-grocery retailers are in the same kind of boat. Professional services or personal services, these are the barbers and hairstylists and nail salons and similar types of businesses. They're not faring much better. Construction, arts and entertainment. You see that these businesses that often require groups of people to be together are the ones that are going to struggle the most. And so this paints a pretty desperate picture, I think. When you look at how much cash is on hand. Now, I say all of that, and I'm on slide 9, not at all to make an argument for prematurely opening businesses, because I think that there's another point that bears some emphasis, that these businesses are closed and social distance measures are in place, both advisories and mandates, for very good reasons. If to the extent that people see a conflict between the economy and public health, it's worth looking at what professional economists have said on this matter. And this was a survey done of economists, asked the question about asked whether they agree with this statement about whether a policy response to coronavirus involves accepting or tolerating very large economic contractions. In other words, do we have to tolerate economic pain in order to get past this public health disaster? You'll see that the majority said that they strongly agreed. Large numbers said they agreed. It's nearly unanimous that economists agree on some level, only 5% uncertain, and there were none who disagreed with that statement in this survey. So I think that's something that is important to note, that as bad as the pain is for public health reasons, you know, the best professional opinion available says that those are advisable. And also that it's not all about mandates, but in a lot of cases, the advisories or in places that didn't have mandates but still had the same public health advisories, businesses still have suffered. And so reopening things doesn't necessarily fix them either, even if that was advisable. So I always feel like I need to mention that caveat. On slide 10, now obviously the federal government responded in a very big way to the challenge that's facing businesses. The CARES Act, you know, included the centerpiece of it was this Paycheck Protection Program that the $350 billion went into, and that funding got used up really quickly. It was less than 2 weeks, and the money was gone. And I mean, it's a staggering rate. I wouldn't have guessed that $350 billion would go that fast, but it did. And that program had its central feature is that it provided the forgivable loans to businesses, especially for maintaining employee headcount. The loan would be forgivable if 75% of it was spent on on payroll. There were some other expenses were allowed as well, but it had to be spent on payroll primarily, 75%, and then it would be forgiven. It had to meet a few other conditions. That program made about 5,000 loans in Alaska. Just under 200,000 was the average loan. So the program probably did a fair amount of good. The other program, the Economic Injury Disaster Loan, is that program offered a loan advance, which was really more of a grant upfront to some businesses. And it was supposed to be up to $10,000. In practice, businesses who qualified for that got quite a bit less. And then the remainder of it would be just a loan that had to be repaid over about 30 years. So these programs and these ran out of funding and also have been replenished just this week, just as of, I believe, yesterday, signed into law. Now, some challenges with those programs on slide 11. Now, the challenges here are also pretty important because these programs, even when they're replenished, don't work for all businesses that we see. And the businesses that get left out or the expenses that get left out start to look really important. So one of the first challenges was that the conduit or pathway that the PPP program used to get money to businesses, you know, is working through a network of existing lenders. And also they expanded it a bit too, but a lot of banks that were already SBA lenders were able to kind of move the quickest to become PPP lenders. And that's not necessarily a perfect mechanism for distributing cash to businesses because there was a mix, you know, borrowers had to navigate which banks were participating in the program and which banks would only take existing customers or which ones would take new customers. And so that created a lot of challenges. It was hard for businesses to get that money in some cases because of that. If you happened to bank with a bank that didn't participate in the program, you had a much bigger problem. That raised some serious questions about whether enough small businesses were getting the funding or not. Another issue was that focused on payroll forgiveness. I would absolutely agree with Dr. Ghatabi about the how crucial it is to prevent the severing of the employee-employer relationship to avoid layoffs, right? But there's also a reality that a lot of businesses face the prospect of going broke even after they have already done layoffs, even after they have already laid off their teams, their staff, but they still have ongoing operating expenses, and those are some of the businesses that I'm most worried about closing. Also, for the non-forgivable portions, or for the EIDL, which wasn't forgivable, you know, to have a business that's saddled with debt that they're going to have to repay off in a down economy is a big challenge. We don't know what the recovery is going to be like, and this is also especially an issue with seasonal businesses, especially in the visitor industry, that they are probably not going to have revenue this year or significant revenue this year with an essentially canceled visitor season. Next year could very well be a depressed visitor season. We don't know what it's going to look like. And so they didn't have payroll expenses right now that could be covered by PPP and then forgiven. They have to deal with this long runway before they can actually get to revenue and paying customers. And so that was certainly an issue. And also these programs got very quickly depleted. They did get replenished, but the money went really fast. At one point, the EIDL program had $20 worth of applications for every $1 that it had. And that was before SBA quit taking applications. So those were big problems. And I'm going to pause to see if anyone has any questions before I proceed.
Good timing. I was just about to ask. Any committee members on the line have any questions? Oh, and I also want to note that Representative LeBon joined us at 3:51. Welcome, Representative LeBon. Are there any questions from any other representatives on the line? Oh. I heard somebody. Do you have a question? All right, I'm going to say no, then I want to jump in and have a question. So there was $350 billion spent on the Paycheck Protection Program in 2 weeks, about $900 million of that in the state of Alaska. Can you remind the committee what the second wave of authorization for funding was for that program as well as for the EIDL?
You know what? Actually, I off the top of my head, I know that Congress, that the bill that was just passed put in It was a total of $484 billion in spending, but I don't, I'm trying to remember the allocations. I believe it was on the order of, I think it was, oh, okay, $310 billion. I just have that answer in front of me. $310 billion was put back into Paycheck Protection Program, and I believe $50 billion into the EIDL. I think those are the correct numbers.
All right, thank you.
Absolutely.
All right.
Nolan, this is Moutine. One important point about the new round is that $60 billion is reserved specifically for small businesses.
Oh, and through the chair, thank you, Dr. Kutavi. I think that is also an important point. There was money set aside for small businesses, and that may help with some of these challenges that I've mentioned. So on slide 12, this is a little bit of an illustration of kind of a fluid situation that we're in. But a group that I have been working to convene is a group of statewide economic development organizations. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. Put forth this recommendation to the governor and the state legislature that money be set aside into grants for businesses from the CARES funding that the state is receiving. A group of us signed off on a letter that I provided to the committee, and our reasoning for this was that simply that more aggressive measures needed to take place in order to help businesses for a lot of the reasons that I've identified, that there would still be certain gaps remaining in PPP and in EIDL, even though they are extremely valuable programs that have done a lot and will continue to. What I didn't appreciate is that this morning, after we put this letter together, the OMB director told the House Finance that the guidance from U.S. Treasury indicates that the state couldn't put that the state had wanted to put $300 million, at least the governor's office wanted to put $300 million of that CARES funding into loans, and apparently that is discouraged under the U.S. Treasury guidance. And according to the OMB director, now the $300 million is likely to go into grants. So our statement on this might have expired as a result of that. Although I would want to press forward the importance of grants for businesses, and I think that the value that those could bring in correcting some of these challenges and in helping to shore up businesses in our state. And so I'm also happy to speak more to that as there are questions. But I think that some of the aggressive measures required, it may in fact be more valuable to provide grants to businesses to help them cover operating expenses. The metaphor about the economy being in a coma or in stasis, I think, is really relevant here, that when the pandemic fear is gone, the capacity of businesses to rehire and to continue to operate is something that's very much at stake here and that needs to be tended to.
And I just want to jump in here for a second because it may be counterintuitive to some people that we would want to give loan, but that we'd want to give grants to for-profit businesses, the earning potential for businesses who have not been able to earn any revenue over the last couple of months, they're not going to be able to make up that revenue in coming months. In fact, they're going to continue to be stressed out. And so rather than deferring, you know, a huge debt that businesses will have to carry on their books for a long period of time, which could add an additional stress, a grant would help sort of push money out, keep as many people on payroll as possible, and get those businesses healthy as quickly as possible. Is that a fair statement?
Now, Madam Chair, I would absolutely agree with that. I think that there's a very strong prospect that businesses that have to take out large amounts of debt are going to have to repay that debt in an economy that may very well be somewhat depressed for a while. And so I think that that's a concern that I have.
All right, thank you. Are there any other questions from the committee on this topic?
Chair Sponholz, this is Rep. Hannon.
Go ahead.
Professor Klauda, you spoke to the fact that...
Chair Sponholz, this is Rep. Story. I have a question.
All right, we're going to go with Representative Hannon, and then Rep. Story will be up next. Thanks.
So, Professor Klauda, you were speaking to the fact that OMB Director Steiniger this morning presented, well, you referenced speaking to him this morning, and he presented to the Finance Committee this morning, and that $300 million in receipts that was in the RPL designation to go for small business relief. And I just want to clarify, and perhaps you expand upon your conversation with him, since it wasn't spoken directly to at the Finance Committee, And I would be delighted to hear that the administration is recommending that that money could be used as grants to small businesses, and that we could streamline its distribution via regional economic development councils. But that kind of questioning hasn't happened on the record. So if you could expand on your conversation with him on that theme in response to your letter.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, my apologies for not being clear, but what I actually was referring to was spoken on the record this morning in House Finance. The OMB director said that it was actually in a really brief aside when he was being questioned by Representative Knopp, I believe, and said that the U.S. Treasury guidance indicated that grants would be a more suitable use of funding than loans. So that was in House Finance. I did not have a separate conversation with the OMB director. And also as a minor point, I appreciate being called professor, but I'm actually not a professor. I am a lowly master's degree holder. So I'm not considered faculty.
Thank you for both of those clarifications. And I must have missed that questioning from Representative Knopp when I was refreshing my coffee, but thank you. It does tie back into questions I had about that presentation this morning, and thank you.
All right, thanks. And then next up we have Representative Story and then Representative Torres' question.
Yes, thank you for all this information. I'm finding it very helpful. I'm trying to, in my mind, clarify when you say small business, what size are we talking about, and is that the different sizes, does that have any bearings on the different loans?
Through the chair, generally a small business, there's a fairly broad definition of it that works for most purposes. A small business is usually a business that has 500 employees or less, which means that includes some businesses that we don't think of maybe as being particularly small. Under the prior iteration of these programs, when they were first passed, generally small businesses would be eligible if they met the certain criteria. So generally those with fewer than 500 employees would be eligible. As Dr. Ghatabi pointed out, there is a certain portion of the funding in the most recent bill set aside for even smaller firms, I believe. And I'm actually not certain of the mechanics of how that works.
Yes, thank you. Just quick comment and follow-up. Yes, I heard that the additional funding was stated for businesses more in rural areas, but I didn't know what they meant by smaller. So thanks for trying to answer.
All right. Representative Tarr? Did you have a question?
Hello?
Hi. There you are.
Okay,
welcome.
Sorry.
To House Labor and Commerce Representative Tarr.
Sorry, because I had it online as well. I was just very interested. Thank you, through the chair. I appreciate the opportunity to ask a question. In that earlier meeting, it also came up, and I think Representative LeBon was the one that brought it up, that the suggestion that these funds go through ADA and AHSC may not be the best way to do it because they would otherwise have these small businesses would otherwise have relationships with their local banks. And so I just wondered if they're talking about doing grants, and I'm sorry if I missed it, what would be the mechanism? How would those funds get passed through? And so, you know, it wouldn't be the AHSC and the ADA, it would be some different kind of program, and who would administer that?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, thank you for that question. I think that's kind of the $300 million question. Who would administer it, and what potential avenues are available for it? I think is something that deserves some very careful attention. I do know that under SB 241, there was a provision in there that funding could go through the Department of Commerce and be distributed via the Alaska Regional Development Organizations. So I know that that's one pathway that's been talked about as far as funding getting distributed. Those organizations are regional economic development entities that you know, represent certain regions of the state, that they may have more knowledge of local conditions and so forth. That could be one mechanism. I know that there has been talk among some trade associations or industry associations like ATIA that could distribute money to, for instance, tourism businesses. I think that warrants a pretty serious conversation. I would say that it needs to be it does need to be a fairly efficient channel. It needs to get money out pretty quickly. I think the timing is pretty important. It can't be overly onerous, but at the same time, you know, it has to balance some accountability measures so that the money goes where it's needed and doesn't get misused. I think that there's a big conversation to be had about that. I would suggest strongly that the economic development organizations in the state be a part of helping to define that conversation, I think. And I was actually going to speak a little bit more about those organizations in the last few minutes of my presentation.
Thank you.
Right, and I just want to be mindful of the time. You've got about just a couple more minutes here, Mr. Clauda.
Madam Chair, thank you. So on slide 13, and I'm going to skip forward to slide 14. So something that I've been working on, there are various task forces and working groups that have emerged to help respond to to COVID-19 from an economic standpoint. And a group that I've been convening is made up of the organizations that you see listed here on slide 14. This includes the Alaska Regional Development Organizations, as well as some economic development corporations that are not part of the ARGR program, but the group does include, for instance, Anchorage Economic Development, Juneau Economic Development, Fairbanks Economic Development, Southeast Conference, Southwest Alaska Municipal Conference. Also includes some funding organizations like the Denali Commission and the Economic Development Administration, as well as some programs like mine that are at the university, like the Center for Economic Development, the Alaska Small Business Development Center. We're moving towards kind of establishing and formalizing our group, but we've been I think a really strong voice for sharing practices between communities. Bill Poff, co-chairing the Anchorage Economic Resiliency Task Force, we've been able to share lessons that he's been able to apply towards other communities in the state, and I also participate in that ERTF, by the way. So this group has done had a lot of good information sharing and coordination. We've also provided input to Mark Begich and Sean Parnell. Just yesterday, we hosted the three members of our congressional delegation joined our call for about an hour and gave us updates and answered our questions about the federal legislation. So I would submit to this group, to this committee, that this group of economic developers is here at your disposal to help with defining some of these types of issues about how to help businesses. We are boots on the ground when it comes to helping businesses, and we're also really key to helping local governments be advised on the economic recovery. And so I submit that to this group for your benefit. With that, I am happy to wrap up and take any final questions if there are any.
All right. Are there any additional questions from the committee? Are there any questions from other representatives on the line? Representative Laban?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick comment. If grant money is intended to be distributed to businesses through ADA or AHFC, involving the banks is, I think, very important. They know their small business customers better than anybody else. The challenge will be that the demand for that money will be over subscribed quickly. There'll be more demand than supply. So it's going to be really important that whatever process is put in place, that the banks are part of that decision-making process. And maybe ADA, AHFC, and the state can be also part of the allocation of those monies. I guess the point I made earlier in House Finance is it's just important to involve the banks, and it's also important to do it on at least a prorated basis. It should not be a race to the finish line, first come, first serve, but allow banks an allocation of money and time to make an informed, good decision about how that money is invested. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much for your comments, Representative Obama.
Through the chair, thank you for that, Representative Laban, as well. And I did want to also add that the conversation about grants, I would be remiss if I didn't point out that nonprofit organizations are also really important employers as well. And so it's easy to talk about small businesses and neglect to mention that, but I think that they should also be part of that conversation too.
Well, Mr. Clotto, that is a perfect segue to our next presenter, who is Lori Wolf, the CEO and president of the 4-Acre Group. Ms. Wolf, are you on the line?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
All right. You want to put yourself on the record and proceed with your presentation?
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Bonholz and members of the committee, for this opportunity to present to you today on behalf of Alaska's nonprofits. Shout out to Nolan there. That was lovely. And for the record, my name is Lori Wolf. I am the president and CEO of the 4-Acre Group. So today I'm here to speak on behalf of the almost 6,000 nonprofits in our state who partner with federal, state, and local governments and private industry to serve Alaskans and who have responded to the COVID-19 pandemic. Slide 2 highlights nonprofits' contributions to Alaska's economy every day. Importantly, nonprofits are a major economic driver for Alaskans. We deliver essential services, leverage public funds for maximum impact through public-private partnerships, invest in our communities, and ensure community well-being and quality of life. Alaska nonprofits play a critical role in the state's economy, both as major employers and as revenue generators. No industry in Alaska can prosper without the strength of the nonprofit sector. We are part of healthcare, fisheries, and the oil and gas industry. We provide essential services such as firefighting, early child care, basic utilities, housing, and food security, just to name a few. We are the safety net across Alaska. Every Alaskan family is the beneficiary of a nonprofit because nonprofits are woven into the fabric of our communities. Slides 3 and 4 help us better understand nonprofits. While most people think about nonprofits, they think about our 501c3 or charitable nonprofits with missions like health and arts and conservation and education and many others. While 70% of Alaska's nonprofits are charitable, it is important to note the other types of nonprofits that are important and contributors to our economy. These other nonprofit classifications include 501c19, or veterans organizations who are included in the CARES Act, and others who are not, including the C4s, our social welfare organizations, our C6, our business leads, and our C12, that are electric utilities, and our C14s, like state chartered credit unions. Without getting into all the ways nonprofits impact the economy, I provided a snapshot on slide 5. You can find our full economic impact report on our website, or I'm happy to send you a copy as well. Suffice to say here that we did employ 44,000 Alaskans and represent approximately 17% of the state's workforce, with over 40% in some regions. In 2016, the last time we have this data, nonprofits generated $3.8 billion in total income and generated $6.98 billion in revenues into the economy. Nonprofits are responsible for creating jobs in Alaska, but we often lose sight of these impacts because nonprofits are not seen as an industry in and of themselves. In our Department of Labor, we track jobs by industry, not by sector. There is no distinction as to which sector the work originates. For example, we've heard lots of examples of that even today, so I'll give you a few more. For example, we talk about healthcare or fisheries as if it's all one sector, when in fact it takes all three sectors, nonprofit, government, and for-profit, to be successful. This is true for all aspects of our workforce. We are impacted in every way that both Lucene and Nolan have noted today. What is also true is nonprofits are integral to our economy. In rural Alaska, nonprofits are often the largest source of employment, accounting for nearly half of all jobs in some areas. Nonprofits play key roles in strengthening the state's other largest industries, Without hyperbole, it is not possible for government at any level or any industry to do their work without a vibrant nonprofit sector. We are in this pandemic and in this economy together. 6 weeks ago, as we were just going into quarantine, we surveyed the nonprofit sector. We had a quick and big response from across the state and across missions, which in and of itself should help us understand the urgency. There is a lot of data in your packet on slides 6 through 10, but rather than going into the results in detail, I'll paint an overall picture for you. For ease of understanding, nonprofit impact can be classified in two ways. First, an increased demand to adapt quickly and expand service and delivery options while losing volunteers, money, and spending reserves. And two, closure of organizations in the name of public health who lost all revenue while needing to maintain missions, facilities, and expenses. Many of these groups will see another hit with the loss of tourism dollars this summer. Additionally, human service nonprofits are likely to continue to face significant increased demand for some time to come. For example, domestic violence providers expect increases in the need for services, including orders of protection. Food banks and food pantries are already recording a 50 to 80% increase in food requests. Homeless shelters and related service providers are seeing spikes in the need for their services. And mental health care nonprofits are already seeing increases in patient numbers. Importantly, based on the survey that was, again, 6 weeks ago, almost 15% of those nonprofits already said they were at risk of closure. At the same time, nonprofits are filling significant gaps in Alaska while facing resource challenges from cancellations or postponement of fundraising events, a decrease in volunteerism, loss of earned income due to closure, and impact on their investments from a declining stock market. As you consider how to improve our economy and respond to this pandemic, I offer you three overarching considerations in your approach to the nonprofit sector, starting on slide 11. Nonprofits need a different but connected response to your effort to support small businesses, local governments, and tribes in Alaska. The first consideration is that we need to plan for the future we want to see in our recovery and beyond. So imagine an Alaska with no museum, no shelter for the homeless, and no care for our seniors. Imagine no summer camps, no faith congregations, no industry associations, and no after-school care or no economic development program. Imagine an Alaska where we are 100% dependent on private industry and government to provide for our residents. This is not how Alaska works best. Instead, we need to plan for the future we want for Alaska. Alaska's nonprofit sector isn't just nice to have, it is essential to every Alaskan every day. And every nonprofit, just like every business, has been impacted by this pandemic. These are unprecedented times, and nonprofits are rising to the occasion as fast as they can to serve Alaska. They are also living on thin or no margins, and those with reserves are now spending them to survive or scrambling to request philanthropic support that cannot fill all the gaps. Truthfully, without state support and a generous outpouring of donations, nonprofits will face major changes, deep cutbacks, and some closure. The second consideration on slide 13 is one of timing. Nonprofits, just like our small businesses, will need support in two timeframes and maybe even three. They need support now for the adaptations to ramp up and serve Alaskans and to maintain their missions with closed programs and no revenue. And they'll need it again in 3 to 9 months from now, when the PPP is over, most CARES money will have been distributed, and our economy has yet to recover. And those that rely on tourism, seafood, and oil and gas will also likely need more support measures in years, not months, to recover from the impact of this pandemic.
Yes,
I
just want to let you know that you got about 12 more minutes.
The third consideration on slide 14 is a recognition that there are many avenues within the CARES Act and many ways to support industries, sectors, and regions. We need the total response to be holistic and recognize the direct and indirect ways that nonprofits were impacted by this pandemic and the ways they will be part of our recovery as a state. I offer a variety of considerations for your response on slide 15, but I'll highlight the most important of them. Every effort to provide relief must take into account the need for operating support to deal with the impact of this pandemic, both in program adaptation, temporary closure, and loss of revenue. Based on these three considerations, here are seven concrete requests to include nonprofits in the $1.25 billion state response. On slide 17, I invite you to say the word nonprofits. Nolan modeled that well for us. For the first time in history, nonprofits are specifically included in relief in these relief efforts. I'll also note it was great to see in the governor's proposal that nonprofits were specifically listed. We need you all as legislators to say the word nonprofit every time you talk about small business. When you exclude us, we don't know our options and we remain invisible to you and your constituents. We need to be visible, not just in the relief effort, but in our collective response and recovery. Second, we need to support all small nonprofit businesses. Alaska nonprofits are diverse and are the backbone of many of our industries. Alaska's response can include all nonprofits who have been financially impacted by this pandemic and who are expected to help with recovery. An example would be our chambers and our economic development entities. Alaska can also offer funding solutions that don't just focus on those with staff, but food pantries are an excellent example as they often run on volunteers with few staff. Granting programs should be based on mission, not just staffing as a criteria for funding. The third request is grants, not loans. Yes, many of our nonprofits have prudently saved reserves to cover contingencies, but this crisis goes well beyond any normal planning scenario. Grants are the best option given our business structure. Simply put, grant options need to be a key component to any workable recovery solution for nonprofits. Our strong recommendation is to create a separate granting option with a minimum of $50 million for COVID response. This grant program should occur outside of the state system by experts and nonprofits to ensure accessibility and a quick and easy, efficient process. We were encouraged, as Nolan mentioned, to hear a discussion today in House Finance, and we hope that nonprofits will be included in that offering should it become available. Request number four is on page 19. If loans continue to be part of the solution, they must be accessible to nonprofits. Expecting nonprofits to comply with the same set of loan requirements as for-profit businesses, like having collateral and asking for CEOs to guarantee loans, are deal breakers. Additionally, making up revenue to pay back a loan is not possible for most nonprofit organizations based on how their business models are structured. Our recommendation is that any loan program be designed with the understanding of nonprofit business models and governance structures. We've developed loan parameters that lower the barriers to participation based on the state-approved criteria for the Pick-Click-Give program, but with an expansion of that program, and I'm happy to share those criteria with the committee after this meeting. Request number five on slide 22 acknowledges that funds from the CARES Act will flow directly and indirectly to local governments. This is another access point for nonprofits who partner with local governments. We acknowledge local governments' need for flexibility to meet the distinct needs of their communities. We also recognize nonprofits' role in meeting those needs. Nonprofits can and should be seen as full partners with municipalities and local governments and the state in delivering of relief services. Our recommendation is to strongly encourage local governments in your district and in your overall guidelines to include nonprofits in both their direct and indirect funding decisions. Focusing on operating grants rather than loan programs will also ensure rapid relief at a local level. Request number six is for state agencies to adopt the current federal OMB flexibility. Nonprofits are quickly adapting to this crisis. They have limited funds, less or no volunteers, and in many cases, less staff. Delivering on plans articulated before the crisis is strained at best. Implementing flexibility across all state granting programs will position organizations to better focus on service delivery without facing reporting penalties and delays in receiving their funding. By avoiding disruptions in grants and contracts, the state reduces the chance that organizations may have to cut services or shut down completely. We have two recommendations. One, ensure flexibility in state grants and contracts by following, at a minimum, the Federal Office of Management and Budget COVID relief rules. And two, recognizing that some guidelines have already been relaxed to help human service organizations respond to this crisis. And before going back to that system, asking nonprofit leaders which of the temporary relaxed regulations can continue based on positive evidence during this time. Going back to old ways of doing business is not always the best choice. Engaging the providers directly will help us keep the rules that deliver the best services in a cost-effective and high-quality environment. Trust, communication, and collaboration between the state departments and nonprofits is getting us through this pandemic, and we must keep that going. Finally, number 7 on slide 24 is about staying transparent and honoring the intent of the CARES Act. Unfortunately, since we are moving very fast to build our relief car and drive it at the same time, there is currently no system to know how money will be allocated by sector. As I noted earlier, current SBA information and labor statistics focus on industry, not sector. And we only currently know labor statistics on the nonprofit sector through our own separate research that we conduct every 3 years. Our recommendation is that the state should create a public-facing dashboard to show how nonprofits, small businesses, and local governments are benefiting from CARES dollars through the SBA, PPP, and EIDL loan programs, and also from the $1.25 billion that will flow through the state. Ensuring intent builds trust and sets us up for long-term recovery across all sectors. By following these 3 considerations and 7 requests, we can ensure that nonprofits can continue to respond to this pandemic and are with us as we recover long into a lasting future. Thank you for your consideration.
All right. Thank you very much for your presentation today, Ms. Wolf. I think that it's really important that as we're considering the economic landscape, that we remember the 5,800 nonprofits in the state of Alaska that employ over 44,000 Alaskans. And I appreciate your taking time to present to us. Are there questions from the committee for Ms. Wolf?
Yes, Madam Chair, may I jump in?
Go ahead, Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do echo the comments about treating a Alaska small business as a equal entity with the nonprofit community. And I'm going to repeat a little bit of what I said earlier. The banks know their nonprofit customers very well. And when we look at grant awards, yes, the banks do need to consider nonprofits in the same light as they view small business customers and come up with a formula that treats both groups in a fair and balanced manner. And finally, my closing comment would be we're going to be oversubscribed, both nonprofit and small business. The need is so great, and I fear that the available assistance and aid will dry up quickly. So we do need to think hard and fast about how we get this as right as we can. And I don't know if I know the answer yet, but bringing the banks into the discussion, maybe in some fashion with ADA, the state, AHFC, to work together to come up with a formula that benefits as many as possible. And thank you, Madam Chair, for that opportunity to make a comment.
I think that's a fair point. I think given that we spent, that there was $900 million in, payroll protection program awards made in just 2 weeks, and it underscores the fact that there'll be a shortage of funds and that we need state programs to complement that using our Federal CARES Act money. Are there additional questions or comments from the committee or other representatives?
All right, then I'll just jump in. You mentioned, Ms. Wolf, that you had recommendations for criteria for nonprofits to be considered that would sort of build upon the Pick, Click, Give program's definition, and we certainly welcome you're sending that information to the committee. The legislature is, you know, in the process of gathering information so that we can move as quickly as possible when we meet again the week of May 4th. So if you could get that to the chair will distribute that to the committee. Thank you.
Through the chair, thank you. I have both a loan criteria document that would make that would be accessible to nonprofits that could be delivered by any entity. And we're also working in partnership with the Municipal League to develop grant criteria that we would distribute to local governments and other entities should the need arise for a granting program. So I will get both of those to you to distribute.
Thank you very much. And I neglected to thank Mr. Clauda earlier for his presentation and insights, as well as your leadership during this time. I think that you know, you've been uniquely positioned to step up into a leadership role supporting Alaska's businesses and nonprofits, and I very much appreciate him. I know the committee does as well. Our final presenter today is Mr. Bill Popp, President and CEO of the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation. Mr. Popp, introduce yourself, ma'am, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bill Popp. I am President and CEO of the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation. I'm also co-chair of the Economic Resiliency Task Force formed by the mayor at the beginning of the current troubles that we are dealing with. I just real quick reference point, Anchorage Economic Development Corporation was created by the municipality back in 1987. It was spun off as a private nonprofit 501c6 membership organization. We function as an economic development organization in partnership with the city. We are also the Alaska Regional Development Organization for the Municipality of Anchorage, so we are a part of the ARDER network. I've been with AEDC for 13 years, Madam Chair, and I can promise you, as many of you probably can already guess, that we are in unprecedented times and that this is an incredibly challenging time of ever-changing facts and ever-changing direction. We are working at the ERTF mainly at this point in time. It is an organization that's been a volunteer organization formed in partnership with all of the other business organizations in Anchorage, from Girdwood to Chugiak, Eagle River, from across Anchorage. That includes Visit Anchorage, Anchorage Downtown Partnership, Chugiak, Eagle River Chamber of Commerce, Anchorage Chamber of Commerce, the Girdwood Alliance, and any number of other business organizations that have come together, as well as several small businesses that have also joined in, and technical support from the congressional delegation and from the municipality of Anchorage. We are focused on immediate response and mitigation strategies. One of our major issues we've been focusing on is communication, as well as providing recommendations to the municipality of Anchorage, to the congressional delegation, and to the state administration on different things that we are seeing, that we are providing advice on, unsolicited, as well as advice that has been requested from us from those various entities. Much of that is being incorporated into the strategies that are being implemented by the city administration. We are focused on, again, continuing the effort also to get better communications out to the business community and to the workforce and the community at large. We've established a clearinghouse page on the web known as AnchorageStrong.info. It is a centerpiece for all information important to businesses, to workers, and to the public. Our focus in the longer term will be on how do we mitigate the damage to our workforce and to our business community once we see what we have left to work with once this is all over with. And we get a clearer sense of what the future direction is going to need to look like. Things that are in our thinking but we are not working on quite yet is what are the strategies we are going to be recommending for workforce retraining for those industries most deeply and affected in the long term, as well as what are we going to be doing to mitigate the loss of businesses in our community, and how do we either backfill those businesses within the existing industry sector, or how do we encourage new business growth in our community to create create new branches of our economy that can replace those that have been badly damaged by what is going on at this time. Today I've brought forward a, and I apologize, this document is not numbered. We just closed it out yesterday. This is the second of two surveys that we have done since the beginning of the COVID pandemic impacts on Anchorage about 6 weeks ago. The first survey was launched the day after the announcement of the closure of restaurants, bars, and other related businesses here in Anchorage, and it gave us an immediate sense of what was going on in the different business sectors. What you have before you today is a survey that was just completed late yesterday. You have the high-level results. We're still working on the crosstabs. I do have some results from those crosstabs that I will share once I dive through the more salient parts of this questionnaire, of this survey. So I would move you forward to question four, if you can page forward to that. And this is a question that we asked at the beginning and asked again in this survey, have you experienced any disruption in business? And we've seen a 5% increase in the yes, which is, you know, obvious that that would go up more, but it was definitely a marked change. When we go to question five, one of the things that we wanted to note in there and highlight is these are what are the impacts, how your business has been affected by COVID-19. About 30% have laid off workforce. 13% of the businesses have closed until the restrictions are lifted. And then a substantial percentage are continuing to operate with employees working from home or operating at a reduced scale, or have also seen their sales dramatically, their sales decline. So that kind of gives you a sense of the different impacts in general terms. There's a whole series of comments provided by the respondents on the next couple of pages, which I'll leave to you to go through. On question six, has your business experienced a decline in revenue from COVID-19 in the last 30 days compared to the same period in 2019? Previously, this question showed about a 68% response. Yes, it is now up to 81%. That's about a 12%, 13% increase, increase in the positive response that they have lost business. On the following page, you'll see the varying levels of lost degrees of lost business. It's pretty much across the board, but does tend to be weighted more at the 50% and above level, with a non-insubstantial portion losing 40%. Down to 10%, and those percentages are on the following page. When we go to question eight, how much do you project your revenues will change in the first half of 2020 compared to 2019? These results have remained relatively the same since we first put this survey out. So we were concerned that we would see a sharp increase in the decrease levels, not that there's much more room to go there, but we were more concerned about it going into the decrease significantly category. But these have all remained relatively the same, still incredibly painful, but at least remaining stable in that regard. And question nine, is your revenue outlook for 2020 more pessimistic, less pessimistic, or about the same? This is a new question that we asked, so I have no comparison from the first survey, but as you can see, well over half of the respondents are more pessimistic about the future than they were 2 weeks ago. So this is showing a rapid decline in optimism for the future over the last few weeks. On question 10, have you made any employment reductions due to COVID-19? Yes is up by 7% since we did this survey at the beginning. So that is not a trend that we like, but at least it is a little bit less than it could have been. We still have over half of businesses that are not making reductions yet due to COVID-19. When we go to question 11, do you expect to make more employment cuts in the future? The yes answer has gone down by about 13%. That's a bit of a bright spot in the survey. In the previous survey results, it was almost 40% that said yes, they expected to make more cuts. So we believe this might be an indicator that the rate of cuts, at least for the time being, is slowing down. Mind you, we've got plenty of people who've been cut, but at least from a future outlook, that's a little bit better. Supply chain been disrupted? Question 12, that's up by about 4% on the yes side of things. And then in looking at, this is a new question at question 13, are the disruptions that you're seeing in your supply chain more severe, less severe, about the same as they were 2 weeks ago? More severe is a little bit concerning at around close to a little over 14%, but it is good to see that at least about the same is a fairly solid number. And then disruptions from vendors and service providers, question 14. That is a question we asked previously. Yes is up by 17%. So that's a pretty substantial increase. That is looking at supply chain issues. So this is probably due in no small part to the national economy and the international economy being in a state of semi-gridlock, and materials and goods and services, and as well as the shut-in, are all affecting this particular issue. On question 15, are vendors, services, and disruptions experiencing today more or less severe than they were 2 weeks ago? This is a new question. Over 23% are saying more severe, which I think underscores the previous observation on the previous question. Here's the big question. Is your business at risk of closing permanently because of impacts caused by COVID-19? Over 15% said yes in this round of the survey. In the previous survey, it was 18%. So there is a little bit of a lessening there. And then the no response on this is up by 15% compared to the previous survey, which means the don't know, the uncertainty factor, is down overall by about 22%, comparatively speaking to where we were about 6 weeks ago. So they're starting to get a growing sense of certainty within the business community. I think part of this has to do with the federal aid that is hitting the street and hitting bank accounts. I think that this is also a chance for business to finally get a moment to breathe and truly look at their numbers and their situation and make some judgment calls that in the previous survey they were unable to make. Question 17 is a new question in this survey. Is the risk today of your business closing permanently greater than it was 10 days ago? Almost 27% said yes. That is concerning. No is still a good solid 57%, and don't know is relatively small at right around 17%. I think that that ends the questions, the observations on the questions. There's quite a bit of detail in terms of what businesses are doing to mitigate the impacts. You'll see that in the next seven pages, the final pages of the survey. I'll leave it to the members of the committee to go through those and to take a look at them, but I think it'll give you a sense of the innovation, but also the dire circumstances that many Anchorage businesses are dealing with right now. Madam Chair, with that, I think I will close out with just one last set of comments. In regards to the grants initiative discussion that's been going on in today's committee meeting at various stages, AEDC was one of the early proposers of a barter-based grant program that would use fixed grants rather than fixed dollar amount grants that would be disseminated to businesses. It could be scaled based on the size of the business. It would be focused on businesses with 50 employees or less. The ERTF then followed up with another proposal that was of substantial nature, a $125 million grant proposal where businesses would receive a flat $10,000 grant distribution with certain basic requirements, an Alaska business license, employees that are working here in Alaska based on the numbers, a number of other criteria that would give accountability and reasonability to the grants being distributed. But the bottom line is that if you get into loans, you get into a much more arduous process, you lose a higher percentage of the original funding to processing costs that are associated with a loan. There are programs nationally that we have identified, including one that I would point you to, taking a look if you Google it, on the city of Boston. They have put out a simple grant program that has very credible criteria that allows for grants $10,000, $5,000, and $2,000 range based on the business size and its needs. These are things that could be incredibly important. They may seem small in the tidal wave that we are dealing with right now, but if you get it into a competitive process, you're going to have the higher likelihood of winners and losers in the process, no matter what you do. And if you start to get it into the complexities of banking decisions and financial decisions that are based on customer relationships, that also brings in a fairly significant challenge, because you have a large number of businesses and a large number of entities doing business in Anchorage that are licensed businesses that don't necessarily have an ongoing relationship with their bank, but are still an important part of the employer base in our city. So I would offer that of the $300 million, I would urge the government, the state government, to consider strongly a portion of those funds being dedicated up to this $125 million that I did refer to, out of that $300 million for grants to businesses and nonprofits, because I think that that's a critical piece that can be deployed fairly quickly with a strong partnership between the different economic development organizations and many nonprofits that have the capacity in terms of staffing and capabilities to go through a very simple set of criteria, vet the grant request, and get it out on the street. And with that, Madam Chair, I'm happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
All right. Thank you very much for your presentation today, Mr. Pop. I think it was insightful, and it's nice to hear that businesses, in some respects, are starting to think things are getting a little bit better, given that we've had job losses that are fivefold our recent recession that have taken place in the last 5 weeks. I can only hope that it's going to get better from now. Are there questions from the committee?
Chair Sponholz, this is Rep. Hannon.
Go ahead, Representative Hannon.
Mr. Pop, if you could remind me, I noticed that in the question responses, they span in time from April 14th to April 22nd, and then you're referring to a 2 weeks previous. So could you give me the time frame that the survey was conducted, and when the if you did one initially in March, and then the second, this one referring to a time period that started April 14th, it looks like, and so is the 2 weeks previous April 1st through 14th. Could you just help me with that?
Sure. The survey that you have before you started on April 14th and actually closed out on the 23rd. The previous survey was done over a five-day period 6 weeks ago in the early part of March. I believe we launched it on March the 10th, and it ran through the 14th.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Were the same businesses contacted in both of the survey cycles? And were there differences in businesses who were impacted? My initial memory is that some businesses were shuttered by our first mandate in mid-March, but then others were added later. But maybe I'm remembering that incorrectly. So was the survey of the same businesses in both cycles?
Well, I can't claim that it's exactly the same businesses, because this was distributed far and wide, and it was a self-selection business survey. It was distributed through the business network of Anchorage. All of our associations and partners were distributing it to their membership. We were also, and this is inclusive of both small businesses, large businesses, and everything in between, which is represented in the front representation. The survey is anonymous, so I cannot tell you the names of the businesses that responded, because if I asked them their names, I would not get the honesty that we got in these two surveys.
Right, and I'm not asking for their names. Thank you. And then I guess the last follow-up would be, so this was just Anchorage businesses were included in the survey?
That is correct. Yeah, we are focusing both our survey efforts are focused on Anchorage, given our role as the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation.
Right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Are there any other questions for Mr. Pop? All right. Looks like you got off easy today, Mr. Pop. Thank you very much for your presentation. I think that, I'm incredibly sobered by today's presentations. I think that we learned a lot, and I just want to underscore a couple of things that I think were particularly sobering for me, and that is that, you know, as I just mentioned, you know, we heard from Professor Ghotabi earlier today that we have lost more jobs in the last 5 weeks than we – 5 times more jobs in the last 5 weeks than we lost in the 3-year period of our most recent economic recession, or 4-year period of our most economic recent recession. That's really staggering, and while we hope many of these people will get their jobs back as we loosen up on some of the public health measures to prevent the spread of COVID-19, it's not exactly clear. We also know that those numbers are probably, you know, do not include a lot of self-employed Alaskans who traditionally wouldn't apply for unemployment. We heard that nearly 5,000 firms in the state of Alaska were approved for paycheck protection loans through the U.S. Small Business Administration. That was almost, it was like $922 million that was distributed. That those 5,000 firms are about 22% of all Alaskan businesses. Those funds were distributed in just 2 weeks before the program lost money. There's a second wave that's coming through. And those applications open up on Monday morning, is my understanding, and I hope that small businesses that are in need of aid will be working with their bankers, as Representative LeBond would encourage them to do, to make sure that they're getting access to those funds. Those funds are largely don't need to be repaid if they're spent on payroll and on rent and utilities and mortgages and things like that. I want to encourage, you know, Alaskans to support one another, to support our small businesses. I want to thank everybody who's testified today. The legislature is going to be meeting again starting the week of May 4th in person, where we'll be taking up some appropriations bills so that we can make sure that these funds get, our CARES Act funds get pushed out to Alaskans across the state of Alaska as promptly as possible, but also as efficiently and appropriately as possible. To that end, this committee is going to meet again on Wednesday at 3:15 to hear a presentation from the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development relating to their proposals to respond to COVID-19 and the governor's proposals. And at this time, it's 5:10 p.m. in this hearing of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. I'm sorry. Is there a question?
Yes, Chair Bonhol.
Go ahead.
This is a story. I really found the question, should the aid vary by place and industry, to be one to be contemplating. And I'm wondering if some of those questions can be passed on that were asked earlier to the people who are going to be presenting, and how we can be sharing some of those questions with the decisions that are before all of us now.
Are you Representative Story, are you referencing the conversation that took place in House Finance today regarding the distribution of, you know, $300 million to businesses across the state of Alaska?
I was thinking about, but also just thinking about future groups, even thinking about getting this information to Senator Begich and Parnell, making sure more groups have access to those questions.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the big questions is, how is it that we distribute those funds? And there was a lot of there's some keen questioning about the distribution of those funds and what was proposed by OMB today. I think that there's going to be a lot of interesting conversation about that. Are there any additional comments from members of the committee or other representatives on the line?
This is Rep. Hannon.
Go ahead, Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Sponholz. I guess I want to just put on the record and share with other committee members and other legislators who are online that I have had two very lengthy conversations with two different constituent businesses who the struggle for their getting aid has been their bank. The banks were overwhelmed, and they would not even process their applications. Now, you know, trying to assure them that there's another wave coming and that that will be the mechanism to process this through is, you know, trying to give them hope. But If our banks are overwhelmed and we're not getting the assistance out there, then we're still leaving them to flounder. And then reminding members that we also have a segment of the Alaska commerce, our cannabis industry, that cannot by law have a banking relationship. And right now, they seem to be one of the few positive revenue streams for us, and but they're excluded from banking. So we want to make sure that we do not put all of our processing of grants and loans into the banking system exclusively, because for some of our Alaskan communities, they're not going to meet the need.
This is Rep. Rasmussen, really fast.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would also like to put on the record in response to the member from Juneau that just spoke that we do have a mechanism to support some of our industries that don't currently qualify for banking because of the federal laws, and I'm hoping if we come back into session that we can address that and try to provide some support to them. And I agree that we definitely need to find a way to help some of these businesses who the voters of Alaska approved as legitimate businesses with their banking needs, because they're legitimate businesses at the state's perspective.
Are there any additional comments?
This is Rep. Story.
Go ahead.
Yes, I also want to go on record that I think it is important to consider the grants to businesses and nonprofits, the smaller amounts that was sort of brought up as what Boston was doing. I'm concerned about many small businesses, but some that have really small mom and pop organizations that, and some are not even familiar with how to network through the banking industry and the different processes involved in applying for some of these loans. And I think it would be very helpful to have a more simple, streamlined process.
Are there any additional comments? I appreciate those comments. I think that it's important that that banks can be a part of the solution, but they can't be the only solution for all of the reasons that have been described by many people, by the other representatives just now. We're probably going to have a series of distribution mechanisms so we can make sure we can get as much money out to the right place as quickly as possible and as in as efficient a way as possible. And then, I guess, are there any closing comments? We'll give one more call out. All right. With that, I'm going to
Rep. Rasmussen.
All right. Go ahead.
I just wanted to thank the chair for putting this together, and I appreciate all of the speakers today. I found the information very, very valuable. So thank you to everybody involved.
All right, thank you very much. We are also very appreciative to all the presenters and all of the folks on the line who listened intently. It's not ideal for us to be meeting telephonically, but this is what we're doing at a time of COVID-19 to try to be safe. And I will see you all virtually on Wednesday for our next Labor and Commerce Committee meeting, and it is 5:18, and we will go ahead and adjourn now. Thank you.